Miles Distributors versus Specialty Construction Brands. Mr. Palmer.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. This appeal arises out of a district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of a distributor or of the defendants in an antitrust case. We believe that the district court erred in two specific respects. One, in failing to consider the differences between horizontal and vertical restraint of trade agreements, and two, failing to consider the evidence as a whole in ruling on the motion for summary judgment, and instead compartmentalizing the evidence and looking at it piece by piece by piece and saying that no individual piece established an agreement. The original motion for summary judgment was presented to the district court as the typical run-of-the-mill case in which a manufacturer fired a distributor in response to a complaint about the distributor being a cost cutter, a discount distributor. There was no mention of horizontal or vertical restraints of trade in the original summary judgment motion. In response to the summary judgment motion, Miles Distributors presented evidence that this was an argument that this was a horizontal agreement. A horizontal agreement between its own competitors to force the manufacturer to eliminate Miles in order that they could maintain their margins, because Miles was, in fact, undercutting them on their margins. It was only at that time, in response to our issue on the horizontal versus vertical, that in reply, Tech, especially corporate construction brands, which is referred to as Tech in the briefs, discuss the issue of horizontal versus vertical. The district court ruled, and here's the distinction. It was our position in response to the motion for summary judgment that a horizontal restraint of trade did not require proof of a post-termination agreement to set prices or price levels. A vertical restraint does. There's no question about that. That was the decision in Business Electronics Corp. versus Sharp. The district court ruled that it was immaterial to determine whether this was a horizontal or vertical restraint of trade, because in either case, it was required that there be an agreement between the manufacturer and the distributors to set price or price levels. And then the court went on to look at the evidence in isolation and rule that there was no such agreement. The court was wrong in saying that was a requirement under a horizontal agreement. Business Electronics Corp. versus Sharp rejected that argument, specifically rejected an argument that an agreement is unnecessary to be illegal per se, distinguishing Park Davis because Park Davis was a horizontal restraint of trade, not a vertical. In fact, as I've read through the cases, I haven't found a case that specifically says it's not required in a horizontal restraint. I also haven't found any cases that talk about it being a requirement in a horizontal restraint of trade. And the reason it's not, the agreement is to set price or price levels is not necessary in horizontal cases, is because by its very nature, horizontal restraints of trade are contrary to competition. They're a group of competitors who scheme and conspire and agree to eliminate a cost cutter. That is just contrary to the Sherman Act. Whereas an agreement between a manufacturer and a distributor can be for perfectly good, legitimate business reasons. And for that reason, in order to be illegal per se, you need the additional element of a post-termination agreement to set price and price levels. So we believe that the district court erred in refusing to draw that distinction. Now, there is evidence in the record as to an agreement or at least concerted action between Miles' competitors to force Miles' termination. There's no dispute that each of the five main competitors of Miles Distributing made complaints to Tech about Miles undercutting them on the prices. There's no dispute that Tech terminated Miles because of those complaints. Although interestingly, that's not the reason Tech advanced when they terminated Miles. In the termination letter, they said, "Well, we're consolidating our Midwest distribution, and after however 15, 20 years, we don't need your services anymore." Well, it came out in the summary judgment that was a pretext. There's no dispute about that being a pretext. There's a memorandum that was referred to in the summary judgment proceedings as the smoking gun. It's a memorandum from Virginia Tiles, one of Miles' main competitors, to its sales staff at the time of Miles' termination. And that memorandum stated that Miles' termination resulted from, quote, many discussions that Virginia Tile and Miller's Wholesale has had with Tech management. That shows there's some kind of knowledge between, some kind of working relationship between Miller Wholesale and Virginia Tile. Now, one spin on that memo is simply that, well, we had separate discussions with Tech. Miller Wholesale had separate discussions with Tech. We didn't work together, and therefore there's no evidence of an agreement. That's one spin. The other spin is that we had conversations together with Tech management. And because of those joint conversations, there is the agreement, the horizontal link in the agreement to restrain trade. I think if you read the rest of the memo, it establishes that Virginia Tile knew it was doing something wrong. It warns its sales staff to tell any customers or respond to any inquiries that this was a Tech decision. We didn't have anything to do with it. Again, quoting the memo, do not imply that it was the result of any discussions we have had or any dissatisfactions we expressed, over the manner in which they marketed their line. So at least there's an indication in that very same memo that not only did they work together to eliminate Miles, but that they knew they were doing something wrong. The horizontal nature of this agreement is also evident in the plan to terminate Miles. This wasn't just simply a situation where the competitors made complaints and Tech as a manufacturer said, okay, you're right, we don't like Miles undercutting you, they're gone. This is a situation which after the complaints were made, Tech went out and they talked to each of the competitors saying, if we were to get rid of Miles, what would you do? Could you pick up the slack? And they entered into this agreement in which there was a blitz of faxes and emails to Miles' clients and customers before Miles even knew it was being terminated. It was at the exact same time saying, Miles is no longer one of our agents or employees or distributors. Miles is no longer selling our products. We're taking over for Miles. And it wasn't just that. What's even more critical is the fact that two of the competitors agreed to put Tech's products in stores where they had not had them before. One in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I take that back. Let me phrase it. There was Tech products in Cleveland, and the distributor, the competitor there, agreed to increase the Tech presence in Cleveland. It did exist there. But in Chattanooga, Tennessee, there were no Tech products, and one of Miles' competitors, in return for this agreement to terminate Miles, agreed to begin stocking Tech products at that store where they had never stocked before. It's a quid pro quo. You get rid of Miles, we'll start marketing your product down here.
This is what's the timing again, Mr. Palmer? Communications?
In the communications?
I mean, certainly Tech could make a reasonable business decision to terminate based on complaints, right?
Correct.
So that they've received?
Yes.
You're saying they don't make that decision until they're assured that other distributors will pick up the slack? Is that it?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, now, just stop there. If at that point, there's nothing wrong with, I suppose, putting that in the mix, is it? The Supreme Court doesn't suggest that if the decision to terminate because of complaints, can there be a parallel interest in maintaining, you know, your distribution chain or volume or whatever?
I would agree with Your Honor that it enters into the mix, but I think what's particularly important here is the quid pro quo of we'll introduce your product somewhere else where it didn't exist before if you fire Miles. To go to your suppliers and say, can you pick up the slack for Miles if we decide to get rid of them, I think that's a legitimate business interest. But to have one of them volunteer to require, and the evidence isn't clear, if Tech required introducing the brand in Chattanooga or if it was volunteer that we would do that, that quid pro quo changes the mix a little bit, and it shows that there is an agreement. And the agreement is to restrain trade.
I guess that's what I want to make sure I understand your position. What exactly is the quid pro quo, and when does that come into the – that's what I was talking about on the sequence.
It was prior to the decision to terminate Miles. It was in the discussions about what can you do to pick up Miles slack. And then the discussion turned into, well – we don't have your product in Chattanooga, Tennessee. How about if we start putting it in there? Or we don't emphasize your product in our Cleveland store. We'll start to re-emphasize it there.
I'm sorry. Your position is that kind of conversation could only occur post the actual termination of Miles so that there would be no suspicion that this expansion of Tech products in stores, not yet distributing them, that's the only way to avoid any suggestion that there is an agreement, an illegal agreement.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think it's also important to note that Miles wasn't competing in Chattanooga, Tennessee. This isn't just what can you do to pick up the slack if we get rid of Miles and take their territories away. It's opening a completely new market in return for...
Yeah, I guess my inquiry is it just that it's suspicious because of the timing? Certainly, a distributor could talk in terms of one subject being, we're going to pick up the Miles slack, and two, by the way, while you're on the phone, could we... you know, we have a store in Cleveland that isn't currently using Tech products. Is it your suggestion it's the closeness of those discussions that gives rise to the suspicion of an illegal?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, it was all in the same discussion. It wasn't, by the way, we also like to introduce in Chattanooga. They said, well, if we get rid of Miles, will you introduce the product in Chattanooga? And they said, yes, we will. There's also an email from the president of Louisville Tile to one of the officers of Virginia Tile, which says, and I'll quote this also, Miles continues to poach work from us in area. It is very important that our two companies take the high road and work together. One spin on that email that was presented in the Appley's brief is that had nothing to do with Tech and had nothing to do with this product at all. Another spin, if you read the original email from which that was responding, is that the original email was talking about Crossville product, and the response from Louisville Tile dealt with that issue, and then completely unrelated to that issue, talks about the problem with Miles. And the problem with Miles was that it was undercutting everyone's prices. So I think there's evidence to at least raise an inference, a genuine issue of material fact, as to whether or not these agreements, or there was an agreement among any of the competitors, and then with tech itself to eliminate Miles as a price cutter, which puts us into the realm of the horizontal conspiracy, which does not require evidence of a post-termination agreement to fix price or price levels. Our alternative argument is that even if you do need that evidence, that there is sufficient evidence in the record to establish that there was a post-termination agreement to maintain, to fix price or price levels. And both the United States Supreme Court and this court has noted that those agreements don't have to be explicit. They can be tacit agreements. They can be unspoken agreements. They can be agreements that if we raise our prices, you'll raise your prices, and so on. And I think that's what we have in this case. By eliminating the discounter, Miles, all of the competitors were able to maintain their margins. And in fact, there's evidence in the record in opposition to summary judgment that two of the competitors specifically did maintain their margins. So that does give an indication that there was an agreement to fix prices. And again, we're talking about a motion for summary judgment. The agreement to fix prices doesn't have to be an agreement to raise prices. If it was just an agreement to maintain the prices as they existed, that's sufficient to establish an agreement. And again, this agreement only is necessary if the court finds that it's necessary for a horizontal agreement, horizontal restraint, or if the court determines that this was not a horizontal restraint but a vertical restraint. This court in the high fructose corn syrup litigation said that there are three traps that district courts must avoid in ruling on summary judgments. First trap is to weigh the evidence. Obviously, that happens in any summary judgment case. The second trap is to assume that if no single item of evidence alone is sufficient to establish an agreement, that all the evidence when considered together cannot defeat a motion for summary judgment. And the third trap is failing to distinguish between the efficacy from the existence of the agreement. I would submit to the court that the district court fell into two of these traps. It weighed the evidence and making a ruling that the defendant's reaction to complaints was based on business decision to retain its larger customers. That's a question of fact that it decided. And it also compartmentalized the evidence and looked at it in isolation and not as the whole spectrum of evidence supporting the existence of an agreement.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. Keyes?
May it please the court. The district court was correct in its conclusion that summary judgment should be granted in this case because the plaintiffs were not able to make out a claim that there was a per se violation of the Sherman Act. The plaintiffs here never pled, never sought to make out a case under the rule of reason standard and to show that, in fact, there was any unreasonable restraint of trade that arose as a result of the challenged conduct. So we confront a case where the question becomes, should the challenged conduct here and the termination of Miles be slotted into that very, very narrow category of cases that are per se violations where we say the conduct is manifestly anti-competitive, and the district court correctly decided that that should not occur here. Tech, the defendant here, was faced with a serious problem that often confronts manufacturers in a distribution environment. Miles, which had been a longtime distributor of Tech products, expanded it out of the northern Indiana, South Bend area, and went into Indianapolis, Grand Rapids, Louisville. And when it did that, it came into competition with other longtime distributors of Tech products. All of these distributors are tile distributors. This product is just the grout and mortar that's used to install tile, and it's a very small part of the tile distributor's business. So these are add-on products that tile distributors take on. When Miles went into those other territories, it engaged in significant price cutting and cherry picking of accounts. What happened was the normal communication that you would expect in the marketplace where these other distributors complained to Tech about what was happening. And their response to it varied from distributor to distributor. One large distributor, Virginia Tile from Michigan, for example, simply told Tech, it's not worth it anymore to really promote your products because we're losing money because of the way in which Miles is operating. One of the other distributors in Indianapolis, American Equipment, brought in another line, a custom of one of the largest in the business, and added that to its product mix. Louisville Tile didn't do that. Louisville Tile was a large distributor in Indianapolis and Chattanooga, but its sales of Tech's products started to drop significantly, dropped by some 34% in 1 year because, again, of this price-cutting competition from Miles. So the manufacturer's standing there looking at this, and it has to decide what to do, what's in its interest in the brand to do. The first thing that it does is that it goes to Miles and has a discussion with Miles, and it suggests to Miles that it raise its prices, which the manufacturer had every right to do under the Colgate doctrine. Miles refuses to do that. So then the manufacturer has to decide, what do we do now? And what it shows is the manufacturer decided we're going to have to decide whether to terminate our relationship with Miles. It had its field personnel prepare recommendations to management about what to do. It's interesting, if you look at those recommendations that were made, that were sent up by the field personnel to the executives, they're written by business people that are really mid-level business people, but it is right, they capture in there all of the policy and the spirit behind the Supreme Court decision in Business Electronics and in Monsanto. What they do is these business people are saying, look, there is price cutting out there. It's significantly hurting our brand because these distributors who have a lot of business, they have plenty of opportunities to shift to competitor products. And some of them are doing that. Others are simply de-emphasizing our product, and it's hurting us in the inter-brand competition in the marketplace, which is obviously the focus of the antitrust laws. And they do say that what our problem is, though, we only have about 10% of the total national market here. If we terminate Miles, we're going to lose sales because Miles is going to shift to, it was carrying competitor products, it's going to shift to those products, and it's going to try to take all the customers to Laticrete, Bonzol, and the other competitor products which Miles has. So these memos say, what are we going to do? Well, these other distributors who are complaining are telling us that they're going to work hard to try to make up any losses we sustain from losing the Miles business, and they're going to do different things. One of them is going to add our product in Chattanooga, where currently it didn't have our product. Another one is going to market Blitz, put on a discount and promotion Blitz in northern Indiana. Another one that has already taken on a competitive line tells us that it'll de-emphasize that line and push our line more. All very pro-competitive, good, legitimate reasons that a manufacturer would look at in terms of making a decision such as this. So the manufacturer then decides we're going to make the decision to terminate Miles, and with the risk that it may lose in the marketplace. It may be the wrong decision, but it's a decision that it makes in its interest to promote the brand.
Is it solid enough that there is no genuine issue of material fact on any of these issues you're raising?
There is, Your Honor. There really was no on any of these issues. We tried very hard on summary judgment to take all of the allegations that the plaintiff made, all of the inferences that they draw from the facts, and say, you know, we're going to stipulate all of these facts. And there was really no dispute about what happened. The only dispute about it is what are the legal ramifications from that.
But there are inferences to be drawn from some of these memos and emails, aren't there?
Well, I think that there may be inferences to be drawn, but none of those inferences, we can't draw any inferences from those emails that would lead us to any per se illegal conduct. Let me give you a couple of examples, the ones that they cite here, the two memos that they talk about. One memo that they use to try to argue that this was a horizontal conspiracy that was illegal between the distributors is an internal memo that Virginia Tile, one of the distributors, sent out internally to its field force a few days before the termination of Miles, when it learned that the termination was going to occur. And in that memo, Virginia Tile says to its field people that it starts off by saying that this morning, Tech is notifying Miles of South Bend they will no longer be a Tech distributor. This is a culmination of two things. One, many discussions that Virginia Tile and Miller Wholesale has had with Tech, and two, Tech's consideration for the manner of marketing that Miles Distributing uses and the compatibility to their long-range goals. So that's the language. Now, the plaintiffs say, well, look, this memo says that there were many discussions that Virginia Tile and Miller Wholesale has had with Tech management. So we must take that and infer from that that there was some type of horizontal illegal conduct between Virginia Tile and Miller. There's absolutely, on the basis of this record, there's nothing that of such an inference that we could draw from that, certainly nothing that would lead to an illegal inference. Because of the fact as follows. We have admitted, in terms of the factual record, that all of these distributors did, in fact, complain to the manufacturer and complain about Miles price cutting. This simply says that, in fact, Virginia Tile and Miller has had discussions with Tech management. And the most that we can draw from that is exactly what we're saying, and that is that these two distributors have complained to the manufacturer about the price cutting. We've also stipulated that for purposes of summary judgment, let's assume that, yes, that Tech did, in fact, terminate Miles because of the price cutting. But all that gets us to is four square within the Supreme Court's ruling in Business Electronics, which said that the agreement between a manufacturer and complaining distributors to terminate a price cutter because of the price cutter cutting is not enough to raise a per se claim unless there is also an agreement to fix the post-termination crisis. So yes, there might be inferences we can draw from this memo, but none that could lead to an avoidance of summary judgment. The other memo that they point to, and I would point out that these are the only two pieces of evidence, these two memos, that they have out of tens of thousands of documents that were produced in this case involving all of these distributors and years of activity. And this is all I could come up with to show that there was some type of a cartel or horizontal agreement between these distributors, which was illegal. The other one, by the way, the Virginia Tile one, is at Appendix 373. The other one, the alleged poaching memo, is at Appendix 381. And what this was, two distributors, Louisville Tile and Virginia Tile, were having an email discussion, not about Tech, but about a tile product that they each carried called Crossville. And unlike in Tech, none of the distributors had exclusive territories. Indeed, none of them even had written distribution agreements. They simply bought and sold the grout and mortar product. In the tile business, some tile distributors do have exclusive territories, and in Crossville is a type of tile that's sold. And the distributors have exclusive territories. And the Virginia Tile, Louisville Tile, and Miles were all Crossville Tile distributors. And the memo specifically, the email chain specifically concerns Ray Crossville stuff. And Virginia Tile and Louisville Tile are talking about the fact that they have with respect to Crossville, they have profit passover arrangements, which are common when you have exclusive territories. I'm a distributor. I want to sell into your exclusive territory because I have some opportunity to do it. So I do that, and then I pass some of the profit over to you. They were talking about that, talking about Crossville, and in that context, a memo about Crossville stuff, the language that they jump on is language which says, Miles continues to poach work from us in areas. It is very important to all that our two companies take the high road and work together. Now, the only inference that we could, that they specifically use the word poach, which obviously is in line with exclusive territories going in and poaching in a territory and not paying your profit Passover. But even if you assume that they were, even if you assume somehow that they were, that they had, they were talking about tech, where does this get us? They simply have a memo where they're saying it is very important to all that our two companies take the high road and work together. What, where does that advance at all? Are coming to a conclusion that this is evidence that they entered into an illegal horizontal agreement to engage in some per se conduct in violation of the Sherman Act. And most, perhaps we could infer from this, that they were, that they, and I don't see how you could even make this inference, but maybe you can make the inference to say, let's all talk to tech about the complaints that we have about Miles, and let's assume that happened. Which there's no evidence in the record, by the way, that there were ever any meetings jointly with the complaining distributors and tech, or any sort of communications where there was any group action at all. But let's assume, even though there's no basis for it, let's assume that what happened was that the distributors said, let's all talk to the manufacturer about the problems we're having with Miles. And they did that, and they complained about that, and somehow they did it together. That does not transform this case from a business electronics case into some type of a case involving a per se group boycott or something of that sort. The reason being that we have now a number of cases after business electronics where exactly that sort of thing happened. This court, the Seventh Circuit, decided a case named Byrite, B-I-R-I-T-E, a couple of years after business electronics, where in fact the evidence showed that the complaining distributors had joint meetings with the manufacturer or supplier and complained about a price cutter as part of the underlying evidence. The manufacturer in that case decided to terminate its relationship with the price cutter. The reason why that type of action, even though it might be considered horizontal, the reason why it doesn't amount to per se horizontal conduct in violation of the Sherman Act is that it is exactly the type of normal communication that a manufacturer should receive to find out what's going on in the marketplace so that it can make its decisions about how to best organize its brand in competition in the marketplace. There are a couple of potential, if we were to take the challenge conduct in this case, the challenge conduct being a price cutter, numerous complaints by the other distributors about the price cutter, attempt by the manufacturer to convince the price cutter to raise its prices, but they refuse, discussions about how we're going to make up for the lost business if, in fact, we do terminate, followed by termination, but no price suggesting downstream or any sort of agreement on price. That being the challenge conduct. If we're going to take that challenge conduct and we're going to start slotting that into the per se category of offenses, the result is that it will chill a number of things which we've been warned by the Supreme Court are necessary not to chill in order to have the most efficient and free markets. What it would chill would be, first of all, a manufacturer being able to have honest, open, and straightforward communications with its distributors about exactly what's going on in the marketplace, what the distributors are able to obtain for its products, that is, the prices they're able to charge, and what they're going to do in the marketplace when they're faced with intra-brand competition, competition within its own brand. It is necessary for a manufacturer in the to have that type of free flow of information so that it can best organize its business in the intra-brand context. The other downside that would occur with respect to that would be that the manufacturer would be in a situation where simply because it had multiple distributors complaining, not just one, but it had all of its distributors complaining, which in fact puts it at greater peril in terms of losses in the inter-brand competition, merely because it was faced with that problem, it wouldn't be able to exercise its independent right to terminate the price cutter. Now, one final thing to mention, and that is that they point to the fact that these distributors were they had an ultimate goal of getting the prices raised in the marketplace. Well, they individually, and even as a group, they may have all wanted that. That certainly is the concern of distributors about price cutters. But that, again, doesn't transform these matters into per se violations. The reason it doesn't is that ultimately it comes down to the manufacturer's independent decision with respect to whether or not it can, by restraining competition inside its own brand, restricting intra-brand competition, whether it can stimulate inter-brand competition by doing that. And that's what Business Electronics and Monsanto said. That is a very important economic factor, and we shouldn't let the easy label of per se violation lose that possibility. One final comment, and that is that we're not suggesting here that distributors should not have an avenue of redress when manufacturers engage in antitrust violations, or that they should lose the opportunity to correct those violations. The issue is whether or not they should have to go forward and prove their case under the rule of reason, as is required in antitrust, or whether they should be given the privilege of slotting into per se categories, the danger being when you slot them into the per se category, you can lose viable and important free economic conduct, such as we had here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keyes. Mr. Palmer?
What I did not hear during the argument was any defense of the district court's ruling that it's necessary to establish an agreement to fix price or price levels in a horizontal agreement. There was no defense of that whatsoever. The district court was wrong. The district court's emphasis was wrong in its entire opinion. What I did hear was a lot of arguments about evidence and inferences be drawn from that evidence. That is not the purpose of summary judgment. That's the purpose of a trial on the merits. And as my final comment, the Buy-Right case that was referred to, the reason the manufacturer gave for firing Buy-Right or firing the distributor was that they owed him $632,000, legitimate business reason. But the court went on to say that although the defendants gave a plausible business reason for termination, it finds that the plaintiff has cited additional evidence that gives rise to reasonable inference that defendants acted in concert and that tends to exclude the possibility that defendants acted independently. Although the court recognizes the paucity of the plaintiff's evidence, it cannot say that it is insufficient to withstand summary judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.